Welcome to Bookshelf, bringing you stories of local literary luminaries and some great books to read. My name is Raina Menashe, and I'll be your host for this segment. Today I'm interviewing Rebecca Grant, author of A Sticky Web of Vengeance, Memoirs of a Coach's Wife, the story of James and Rebecca Grant. My guest, who in her life has been both a victim and a victim's advocate, has struggled for years to uncover the truth about her husband's tragic death in 2007. Welcome, Rebecca. It's a pleasure having you on Bookshelf.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Let's start with your relationship with your husband, James Grant, a head track coach from the University of Iowa. What was it about that relationship that changed you so much that the experience prompted you to write this memoir?
Well, it was surrounding around his, my husband was fighting with cancer for a few years before his death in 07. And during the last couple of weeks of his death, my whole life was turned upside down. On July 5th, 2007, myself and a pastor, Reverend Dow from Bethel AME Church in Iowa City, Iowa, helped me to get my husband to the hospital where his memory was gone. He couldn't remember anything, the time, date, year. Wow. He was very combative, throwing water, pulling knives, yelling, scared the kids. And that's because he had over 20-something tumors in his head.
Oh, how terrible.
And he was, several months, he's been fighting with mood change and his mental state, where he couldn't drive no more. He had to have 24-hour care. I bathed him. I showered him. He could do just a little, but not that much. I cooked his food, fed him. He was totally dependent on me. Me and the kids that helped him 24/7, took him to all his doctor's appointments. I did everything with no help but the grace of God.
Okay, so that was when he came down with cancer and afterwards. And before that, what was your relationship like? Because I know that's a significant part of the memoir as well.
We had an outstanding relationship. We had, I would call it puppy love. At first, I met, he was much older than me. And I fought the relationship because he was older than me. And he didn't look at age, but I did. Where I tried to hook him up with a few friends of mine I knew and set those dates up. And you can read all about that in my book. But he was very persuasive. I mean, he even followed me, came to my church and showed up. He was not going to stop until he got me. And I eventually gave in, and we had a love life and a love story that was remarkable. And those are things that I'll never forget to this day.
Remarkable in what way?
We traveled to different places out through United States and also back to his hometown, Jamaica, because he was Jamaican. And just little things that he would have set up if it wasn't a private dinner or a little of walks in the park or just little outings, and it was always beautiful with passionate love that took place, you know, during our rendezvous, I would call them. But he was always full of surprises, and that's what made our relationship great. Not only was he full of surprises, but he was such a kind and gentle man and a good father to my children. And they would never forget him as well as I would either.
Now, I know that there were some conflicts with his children. Is that correct?
That's correct. That was later. From day one, for some reason. Now, they didn't live. He had three daughters living in the New York area. And one son that was Harlem, which he didn't really give me any problem. They had one son that lived in Iowa City. But the crazy part is, I dated him for about 3 or 4 years before I even knew he had any kids.
Oh, wow.
I mean, been to his condo, no pictures, no nothing. I never knew he had any kids until his son, Jamie, came to stay with him. And at the time, he told me it was his nephew. So I never knew it was his son until one day me and Jamie was talking and I was asking him, did he have any other siblings? And he said, no, he was his dad's only child. But his dad had other kids. I'm like, okay, so your dad had other kids? And he said, yeah, my dad, Jimmy. We called James Jimmy for, you know, short. And I was shocked. And I left the house and read the book. The book could tell you more what happened, but I was surprised. I did not know it. And when I did push to issue numerous of times to meet his kids, he was hesitant when I finally got to meet him. And they just didn't like me from day one. They had a problem with my age. They had a problem with my skin complexion. And they had a problem because I was American. They were Jamaican kids. Their mothers were all Jamaican mothers, and that's what they want their father with. But the crazy thing about it, my husband had five kids by five different women, which I didn't know that until later on. He never signed a birth certificate for any of them. Now, he was married to Aisha's mother. And the rest of the kids were like, he was a track star in Jamaica, kind of where you hear the basketball players over here. They're kind of out there sowing their rural oats, and they're with this woman and that woman. And, you know, Suzette, he didn't meet till she was like 8 or 10 years old. And he said he always had his suspicion, were they really his kids? Back then, you know, DNA wasn't a big thing, especially not in Jamaica, in a third world country.
Right.
So he was able to get Jamie tested probably about a year before he died. It came back in 90-something. But he still said that Jamie wasn't his. It was his brother's son, because his brother also dated Jamie's mother after my husband did. So, I mean, I'm not saying that's a Jamaican culture, because it's probably not. It's just something that they did.
Right.
Yes.
So that was something that you accepted and moved forward with the relationship. I mean, it sounds like you had a good marriage overall, and despite these sort of hidden aspects of his life before he met you.
Well, yes, we had a good marriage. And what I had to do, I had to pray on it, because I come from a very spiritual family. I prayed on it. A few months, I would not talk to him, have anything to do with him. We got back together, and he promised he would never keep anything from me again, which he did before he died. You know, that's when I found out that I thought I was like this, you know, second wife, but I was actually the fourth wife. So, you know, a lot of things I learned, and he started coming out telling me things. But, you know, I thank him that he did, you know, before he died, he did get things straight, and he opened up to me. And the reason why he said he kept a lot of those things hidden, he started a new life in Iowa, especially at a Big Ten school, University of Iowa. He didn't want people to look down on him that he had, you know.
Right, sure.
Multiple kids by multiple women.
Yeah.
And he wasn't for sure if those was his kids. But he never denied them. He just, you know, in back of his mind, did not know if they were his. He was unsure about that. And he loved each and every one of them. But they had a very strange relationship with him. My understanding, none of them never came to visit Iowa until a couple months before he died. They all showed up. Now, Suzette did used to live in Iowa with Jimmy. When he first came to Iowa, he sent back for his ex-wife, Janet, and Suzette, and Janet's daughter came. And I don't know the reason why, because Suzette's mother died of cancer, and then he took Suzette to his mother, and she helped raise her, but Suzette was too much for the mother, so he brought Suzette to the States. And he always said that Suzette hated him for that, because she wanted to stay in Jamaica. But the 2 years that my husband fought cancer, and the 2 years that I took care of him, not one of his kids, ex-wife, anybody showed up to help.
Yeah,
until the last days, they all showed up with their hands out. Yes.
So he died in 2007, and then in 2008, you became involved in a lawsuit with the University of Iowa, sort of fighting for your rights as his wife. Talk about that lawsuit and your battle for justice.
Yes, that was a very trying time. In 2007, I need to go back and say what happened. I was sick 3 days while my husband was in the hospital. We took him to the hospital July 5th. I was there the 6th, 7th, 8th, and 9th. I was absent from the hospital. I had a fever. My body was just wore down.
Sure.
From taking care of my husband. I did everything. And his nights and days were mixed up, where he would roam at night. And I was pretty much during the night, especially I having three small kids at the home, and the girls were probably about 7 and 8 at the time. And my baby boy was probably about 13. So it was kind of hard. And you have to watch them at all times, because I know one time we woke up during the middle of the night and we were always choking and coughing. And that was nobody but God that woke us up, where he was sitting in the garage. The garage is attached to the house, and he had started the car, and smoke was all, fumes all in the house.
Oh.
And a few times, you know, you woke up where he had a burner on the stove, turned on the burner. So you had to watch him like watching a child.
Right.
And by me, used to be in the medical field. I was a CNA and also worked in labs. So I knew what I was doing. I knew how to take care of him. And I knew it was the illness. So I was not going to place my husband in no type of home, because I promised him that when it came to him getting where he could do for himself, I would take care of him and be by his side until the end. So those days I was absent from the hospital, my whole life was turned upside down. Me and the pastor, we took Jimmy to the hospital. The doctors then took him down to x-ray and told us that he had a blood clot that has traveled to the brain. So he had less than a few weeks, maybe a month to live. So they told us to prepare ourselves. I had them put a note on the door. Me and Pastor Dow decided that where, you know, if anyone come to visit, they need to check with the nurse station. My husband was a very private man, and he told me he did not want anyone to know he was dying or in the hospital. Even the University of Iowa Athletic Department did not know how bad his cancer was,
because that's a lot to hide.
He wanted to keep his job up to the day he died.
Mm-hmm.
The coaches would come by the house. He would give them orders and stuff, but he was very weak. He cried a lot. He was a mess.
Sounds like he loved his job. He didn't want to let go of it.
Well, he loved his job. But one thing about it, Paula Jantz came to our house as boss, and she tried to get him to up his job. And, you know, then he figured that Lane Anderson, the one that took his place now, was kind of snooping around, wanted his job. And he just didn't, you know, he didn't want it. He needed his benefits, especially with the cancer.
Mm-hmm.
And he did not want to get rid of the job. And there was a nice lady in the community, Iowa City, Marion Coleman, was putting something together so they could still have him within the athletic department instead of trying to take his job away from him. And that's the reason why he did not want them to know how bad he was. My husband had brain cancer, lung cancer, and the cancer metastasized out through his whole body, where the cancer you've seen came out of his pores. You can see marks on his face and different things.
So when you sued the University of Iowa, what was that about?
Well, like I said, during those times I was at a home sick, Dr. Clayman was my husband's oncology doctor. He brought in Dr. Michelle T. Wickman, a psychiatrist, to look at my husband's mental state, because I told you the mm-hmm. things he was doing. She took upon herself and pushed my husband's oncology doctor out of his care, along with the other oncology doctors. And this lady knew nothing about my husband.
Mm-hmm.
And I put my husband at the University of Iowa Hospital and Clinics under John Doe. It was leaked that my husband was there. Also, my husband's daughters was called around looking for him, told them that he was in the hospital. And that's a HIPAA violation, but they did that and got away with it. So during the process, what they did was they took and used my husband. Jamie found out he was up there, my husband's son. So I told Jamie, that's okay, just stay here. My husband was having problems with Jamie. He was being rebellious when my husband wanted him to go back to Jamaica. And my husband didn't have a close relationship with the kids. None did he have a close relationship with his staff. He was a very private man. And we kept everything to ourselves. I want to say March, we went to picked out his casket, because we knew what was going on with the Lincis, you know, picked out his casket with a good friend of ours that came along. And we had everything set for his body to go back to Jamaica, the funeral. We planned everything together. Well, these people came in with the help of Michelle T. Wickman. And for some reason, they had my husband think that our house was a safe place for him to go back to. They also act like I abandoned him up there. And remind you, my husband's mind was gone, shot.
Right.
You know, he couldn't think for himself. So they did all these things. Then I found out that they called his ex-wife, Janet Richardson, to come from Florida. Now, remind you, she didn't have any kids by him. But this same woman showed up at our house in March of 2007 with her daughter and her niece. and wanted to know about his health and things like that. Well, during the process, she brought a bag with some sweaters and it said it was from, you know, her daughter and her niece. Well, as I was going through the things, there was a ring in there where, and a card where she was very upset that he married me and bought me a house and a ring and she wanted him back. And that ring was a part of the topic in the courtroom. But those are things that these people did to me. Not only that, the girl showed up in May of 2007, my husband's three kids, never came any of those other times. They wanted to know if they were in the will and what was he leaving him.
Right.
And they would call constantly that he stopped taking their calls. What was he leaving them? I mean, it was just, I never seen anything like that in my life, and where he just didn't want to have anything to do with them. But to go back to the hospital, I found out on, I went back and see my husband on July 10th, and I noticed the nurse's station, they were acting kind of funny, kept peeking in with me and my daughters, them. Was at the hospital. My husband said, oh, you ready to take me home? You know, he talked like a child. I said, oh, yes, you know, we're going to be taking you home tomorrow when they release you. Well, I get a phone call early the morning of July 11th, was asking if I could come to a meeting at the hospital later on that afternoon. Well, when I got to the hospital, the strangest thing I seen was this ex-wife was in my husband's room. But what I seen was a purse by the bed. And later on, I found it was her, which the book will tell more about that. This Dr. Wickman set up a meeting to decide where Jimmy should go. And as I was walking down with Jimmy to the room where they were going to have the meeting, I seen a little yellow sticky on his planner that I took up there on July 10th. And I took his cell phone that same day. On the sticky, number one, it says divorce, Becky. My nickname's Becky. Number two, Janet, Dual Power Attorney. Number three, Greg Fender, Executor. And I'm like, what is this about? And I said, what is that about? He said, I said, Jimmy, what is that? He said, I don't know. I don't know where that came from. So as we got in the meeting, he sat there and I sat on the other side and then his son Jamie sat by him. And first thing he did, you know, the Dr. Wickman and also Dr. Berg was at the meeting and Iowa City Hospital, a few from Iowa City Hospitals and another nurse from the University of Iowa. And then I looked in the meeting. Here was Greg Fender, showed up a little bit later. There was Victor Houston. He was the assistant coach at Iowa, track coach under my husband. There was Jamie Grant, his son. There was Janet Richardson and the other staff that I mentioned earlier. And like I said, Greg came later. And I'm like, what is going on? Because remind you, me and my husband did everything private. It just always been us.
So your privacy was disrespected and invaded, and then all kinds of, sounds like all kinds of boundary invasions, like with exes and basically not respecting the sanctity of your relationship and your taking care of him. And then also what you inherited afterwards. So how did that lawsuit resolve?
Well, what happened was after the meeting, this Wickman decided for him to go to, the assistant coach's house, and I was very upset about it. So I started right. I would call pastor, told him what happened. He couldn't believe it. And he had a deacon from the church, Melvin Shaw, to represent me because everything happened so fast. The next day I got up real just upset and crying, like, you know, why are they taking my husband from me? I go to the courthouse and me and my daughter and I told him, you know, what happened. I said, you know, I told the judge he was being combative, you know, why he ended up at the hospital. He lost his mind, this and that. Well, they gave me the wrong document, and it was a restraining order to keep my husband away from me. And Melvin Shaw said, oh, that's the wrong document. We have to get that off. So we wouldn't end up getting that off three or four days later, but he ended up going to Victor's house. And during the process while he was at Victor's house, listen to this. He got out on July 13, 2007 from the hospital. The same day he got out of the hospital, his daughter Suzette flew in from New York. Suzette, along with Victor Houston, Greg Fender, and they had attorney. I found out why the days I was sick at home, named Joseph T. Moreland, came to the hospital where they found an attorney for my husband. They had him redo his will. They pushed him to the attorney's office in a wheelchair to redo his will. And that's where the battle started when it came to court. Now, remind you, my husband had everything planned. His accountant, Michael, from New York, came in. And then my husband started making several different wills and where he wanted his assets to go. He didn't leave kids anything. He didn't leave nothing. And I tell people, my husband wasn't a rich man. He was just a track coach. Track coaches don't make that much. He just wanted to make sure the house was paid off that
right.
we
people
inherited
for his family.
And that we had enough to take care of whatever.
Sure.
But that all changed, and that's where the battle of the will came in at. And 2008 was the will contestant, and it was horrible. It was put together, the daughters them lied, the attorneys that was involved, they lied. My husband left me insurance policies and had left everything to my name, and he was supposed to tell me where to take them. I didn't know where to take them. So ended up, my first attorney was Julia Mears. My second attorney was Julia Mears. Julia Mears told me to take them and drop these documents off at the university benefit office and TRA Crafts in Iowa City. I did that. Well, they told me I didn't have a right as his wife to even drop those off, but I'll remind you, I was his wife. I did everything. A lot of things that they did at the hospital was against HIPAA violation. They took me out like right. I was not his wife. I was my husband's dual power attorney. Even the medical documents, my husband signed, do not share no information with no one but his wife and himself. Michelle T. Wickman, Dr. Berg, Dr. Clayman, and a University of Iowa staff violated that, and Iowa City Hospital violated his rights as well as our rights.
Right, which is a huge violation, especially in today's age where we're so concerned about HIPAA and privacy. Without spoiling the book, I know that you took it up to the Supreme Court, so we'll let the readers see what became right. of that. But I know that you sort of segued into becoming a political activist, and you advocate for others. You feel like you've been victimized in several ways. And in addition to the lawsuit, you're fighting for other people in other aspects of your life, that now you help kids fight against racism and bullying, as well as your political activity. So tell us about that. How did your experiences with your husband and the fight against the university lead you to where you are today?
After I sat there numb during that whole process, grieving my husband and then taking his body back to Jamaica, sent his body back to Jamaica in 2007, and how to weigh, I was even, you know, threatened in Jamaica by his kids. And then coming back that following year and going through court and sat there and still did not realize what happened, dealing with depression and just in shock. And as I remember looking around that courtroom and remembering the jurors sleeping and holding their hands up, didn't want to be there. And I thank God for Dr. Andrews. Dr. Andrews was his oncology doctor. I'll never forget when he stood up and he said, it's a shame that you people took advantage of a dying man. This man should not been signing any documents. But one thing about it, what was so unfair, the judge had a lot of stuff blotted out. And that's where I have problem with our justice system. Okay. A lot of things that the jurors would have been able to see was blotted out. And I think our justice system here in America needs to be changed, because you have a lot of people on death row, in prison, or in the grave because of things that the judge blotted out. I think everything should be always shown within the court, everything.
Transparency.
Yeah, because you always hear jurors say after later, well, I didn't know that because we couldn't see it. So we end up losing the will contest. They're going to say that they believe my husband was in his right mind to change his will, because Dr. Wickman said that she did a test on him. Well, later on, I found out, reading the documents this past year, even more, that she never did a test on him. Not only that, through some of the few of the doctors at the University of Iowa that worked there, also said she did not do a test on him. But she lied on a witness stand, lied in documents, that she did a mental test on my husband to see his mental status.
So your motivation is to see justice be done in many places as you can.
My motivation is, after going through depression all these years and angry because of what happened to me, then I go back and look at, you know, being in an abusive relationship. Mm-hmm. And I said, you know, I need to fight back. I need to stop letting people walk all over me. So I started fighting back. I fight for children's rights. I fight for if you're wrongdoing, I'm going to fight for you. And I'm fighting to bring this story to life so this will not happen to anyone else, especially when Big Ten universities always seem to push stuff up underneath the rug if you go back to Penn State. And then you look at the University of Iowa, where they knew and they got away with a lot of stuff that happened, even from documents being stolen at my husband's office, and also the Postal Service under Ron Jewell, that they stole my mail, went through my mail. Postal Service did nothing. Because you know why? They did not want the university to be in the spotlight. So that's why I fight for justice. And I'm going to continue to fight and continue until the day I die to help anyone I can.
And to tell your story.
And tell my
Great.
Story. Yes.
I have one last question then. Is there another book in the works, or is this it?
Well, there is another book in the works. And there's a spinoff from this, because a lot of things that I just found out recently, I'm going to do a spinoff. And not only that, people wanted to know what happened to the author.
So there'll be a sequel.
So it'll be a sequel.
Okay.
So they'll know what happened to the author and when she woke up and when she started fighting.
And when will we see that? What year, do you think?
You will see that book should be coming out early part of 2017.
Great.
And Raina, I just want to say they can also buy the book at Barnes & Noble. It's also on Amazon and also CreateSpace. And also, it's in local libraries out through the world. So if they want to get that book, there's a lot of different places they can get that book.
That's all we have time for now, but thank you so much for joining us.
Yes, thank you for having me once again.
For more information on Rebecca Grant and her work, please visit her website at rg7bookpublishing.com. Again, this is Raina Menashe, and you have been listening to East County Magazine's Bookshelf, bringing you stories of local literary luminaries and some great books to read.